Hello, I'm Esteban Vargas. This is number 0116, the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder, and it comes to you right now.
The following program is brought to you in living color.
Now, it's time for an eclectic mix of interviews and some of the oddest news stories you'll ever hear. It's the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder.
Hey there, hi there, ho there! Peter Anthony Holder here with you, and yes, this is indeed once again the Stuff File program, number 0116. And coming up on this edition of the Stuff File program, Academy Award winning actor George Chakiris talks about the classic film that earned him the Oscar, West Side Story.
I do think it holds up. It's such a wonderful movie, and the creative guys behind this piece in the theater and then the film were just amazing, amazing guys in their respective fields. Jerome Robbins, Leonard Bernstein, Stephen Sondheim, Arthur Lawrence for the theater, and Ernest Lehman, who did the screenplay. I mean, Robert Wise. These are amazing people. So they really did a great thing here.
Lucinda Roux is a world-class figure skater and is known as the fastest spinner in the world. She wrote her autobiography, Frozen Teardrop, which shares some of the pain of her sport.
I have back fractures, so that was from the spins. I injured my body quite a different couple places, so I'm still living with that. And I think the brain concussions, they have long-term effects. I'm still living with those, you know. Like, for instance, I cannot drive a car because I get dizzy very quickly and I will faint. And so if I look very long at a certain place, you know, when you're driving, then I'll lose my sense of balance.
Stephen Kleinedler is the supervising editor of the American Heritage Dictionaries. Their latest edition is out. What criteria is used in putting new words into the dictionary?
You want to be cautious of entering something too soon, which is why many of the words that we have in there as new have actually been around for quite a while. There aren't very many completely brand new words that would go in right away. Exceptions being, for example, when they name new elements. Once the body that makes the decision makes the decision, boom, that's it. You've got Copernicium or Rentenium or Darmstadtium or what have you.
And of course, we have lots and lots and lots of stuff and an idiot of the day. The guest later, the person who told you this was show number 0116, was Esteban Vargas, who is a technical producer at Astral Media. And thank you very much, Esteban, for doing the guest slate on this edition of the Stuff File program. Let's get right to the stuff, shall we? In Chicago, 36-year-old Timothy Schneider apparently needed beer. He needed beer badly. Police say around 4 a.m. he burst into an apartment and demanded beer. Finding none, he then burst into a second apartment with the same demands. He then fought with the tenant and allegedly stabbed him with a corkscrew, an injury that resulted in 22 stitches. When police arrived to arrest Schneider, he reportedly spat on a police officer and told the officer he had AIDS. After the arrest, Schneider was allegedly threatening to kill the officer and said, "You can lock me up forever." He was charged with two counts of home invasion, aggravated battery causing great bodily harm, and aggravated battery to a police officer. You know, these are the kind of guys, anyway, that you never see in beer commercials. I'm just saying. Elsewhere in Berlin, the new Sauvage restaurant is taking diners on a trip back in time for a culinary delight that it serves. It's going way back. On the surface, it may look like any of the German capital's other trendy eateries, but its menu takes its inspiration from the Stone Age. In what they call Paleolithic cuisine, Sauvage serves food only accessible to our hunter-gatherer ancestors more than 2 million years ago. That means no bread, no cheese, no sugar or salt and pepper. Inside, diners eat at candlelit tables with a contemporary cave painting hanging in the background. They only serve organic, unprocessed fruit and vegetables, meat, fish, eggs, nuts, seeds, and herbs. The idea comes from the trendy paleo diet for people who have had enough of the fast food way of life and generations of illness. Those are the ones who have taken it up. A U.S. News and World Report says the regime, otherwise known as the caveman diet, would likely disappoint and was the least effective for weight loss. But a recent poll revealed that 3,292 people said that the diet had worked for them compared to just 85 who said that it didn't. Yeah. And what was the lifespan of our knuckle-dragging ancestors? Just asking. Students at a school in a small town in Sweden were shocked at the response from one lunch lady when they complained about the food. Even school principal Rostgard Evald admitted the school meals had not been up to snuff, and he sided with students who had complained the food was not fit to eat. The lunchroom staff had been trying to heat up some pancakes for hungry students after the food on the menu had been declared inedible. However, the pancakes were served still frozen in the middle, so more complaints ensued. Apparently, one lunch lady decided she had had enough and responded by removing her apron, unzipping her pants, letting her hair down, and then proceeded to start moving up and down against a pole like a pole dancer. When a school counselor tried to intervene and told her this was not acceptable behavior, she just kept on dancing. Principal Evald later told reporters, "Today the matter took an extreme turn, and it is obvious something has to be done." You know, I think there are more conventional ways to thaw out the middle of a pancake. Yes. And finally, in this section of Stuff File News, before we get to our first guest here on the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder, the ongoing flooding in Thailand is calling for extreme measures by the government. Helicopters are ferrying in emergency supplies to the Lop Buri province. Among the top needs, in addition to food and medical supplies, condoms. Local volunteers told us that villagers have nothing to do during the flood, said a spokesperson for the Emergency Medical Institute in Thailand. So to prevent a baby boom, we've added condoms too. And I guess in emergencies they could make excellent flotation devices. Anyway, let's get to our first guest here on the Stuff File program, shall we? It's been 50 years since the release of the classic Hollywood musical West Side Story. Those who know the film well will remember George Chakiris, who played the role of Bernardo, the leader of the Sharks in that movie, a role that won him an Oscar for Best Supporting Actor. It is an honor to have on the line with us right now Academy Award-winning actor George Chakiris. Hi, George.
Hey, hi there. Thank you very much.
Thanks for being on the show with us. It's almost hard to believe that half a century has gone by since that classic film first came out, and that film.
When you put it that way, half a century. It's so incredible because no way does it begin to feel anything like that. I mean, but it is. It's 50 years, absolutely.
Not only that, but the film still holds up too.
Yeah, you know what? I think it does. We went to a screening, a couple of screenings at Avery Fisher Hall and Lincoln Center, where David Newman conducted that incredible Leonard Bernstein score, and there was a screening at the same time. So I haven't seen the movie for a long time, and when I look at it now, I'm objective, and I hope I am. When I look at myself, it's not me. It's like I don't feel it's me. So I do think it holds up. It's such a wonderful movie, and the creative guys behind this, this piece in the theater, and then the film, were just amazing guys in their respective fields: Jerome Robbins, Leonard Bernstein, Stephen Sondheim, Arthur Lawrence for the theater, and Ernest Lehman, who did the screenplay. I mean, Robert Wise. I mean, these are amazing people, So they really. They did a great thing here.
Now, I know you had the opportunity to play in West Side Story on stage, but you didn't play the role of Bernardo on stage.
No, I didn't. I first auditioned for Jerry Robbins for the role of Bernardo, and then he asked me to look at the role of Riff, which I did, and I took 20 minutes to look at the role of Riff, and then I read for Riff, and eventually was cast to play Riff for the London company. Yeah, which was incredible. It's all just too good,
So how did you go from being cast in the stage production to the film production, and were you surprised that Bernardo came your way for the film and not the other character?
I'll tell you what, the whole thing surprised me because when we were doing the play in London, I did it for a year and a half, news started to filter over about the upcoming film production, and we were hearing names like Elvis Presley and Elizabeth Taylor, so none of us ever dreamed that we'd you know, just never crossed my mind, certainly not. But one day, five of us in the London company were asked to do a film test, and my test asked me to do a scene as Riff and a scene as Bernardo. And then the weeks started to go by, and anyway, I ultimately was asked to go to Los Angeles, to Hollywood. It was great because I hadn't seen my family for a year and a half. And I met Bob Wise for the first time, and then I did test for the role of Bernardo, and Jerry Robbins directed the scene. And then I went back into the play again to wait to see what happened with that screen test. And some weeks later, I did get the telegram that told me I had the job. It was fantastic, you know.
Now, you had a great career leading up to that. I mean, you were in Gentlemen Prefer Blondes. You were in White Christmas. There's No Business Like Show Business, Brigadoon, the list goes on. But you come across this role, West Side Story, a big musical in the early 60s. And then the Academy Awards comes around and you get nominated. What was it like, first of all, when you got nominated and also then when you won?
Well, I'll tell you, it was so odd. West Side Story in 1962, the early part of 1962, was the royal film performance in the presence of Her Majesty the Queen at the Leicester Square Theatre in London. There was at that time the film was being screened with an intermission, and during the intermission, Robert Wise and I can't remember, Russ and Russ Hamblin was there, and Richard Beamer was there. We went into a lounge or something somewhere, and at that very time, while we were that break was going on, Robert Wise had gotten a call from Los Angeles telling him what the nominations were, and he told me that I was nominated. I don't even know what I thought, quite honestly. It was just, there was something very quiet about hearing that. But and then the incredible thing about winning it was just, I hate to use that word, winning. We're not supposed to use that word, are we? But about well, getting it, I guess, was I attended the Academy Awards ceremony in 62 with Rita Moreno. We went together, and my category came up first, and, you know, I was lucky. And then later, Rita's category came up, and she was very lucky. Anyway, it was such an incredible evening for both of us. It's it was a fantastic time. You know, that when they call the names, you know, the nominees are, the way I always try to equate the way it felt was, you know, if you buy a lottery ticket, you don't really expect to win, but you kind of hope you will. And that's what it kind of felt like. I mean, I heard my name, and it all happened so quickly. But then when your name is called, and my name was called, it was like, I don't know, you're just sort of on another planet or on something. You're just so overwhelmed or whatever it is. I can never think of the right adjectives. I think most people have a hard time describing what it felt like. But it was a heady experience. You know, it was wonderful. It was great. It was terrific. It was just it was all wonderful. It was great. And again, because I was with Rita, and since we both won, it was just a fantastic memory for both of us.
Now, you reached the top of your game, winning the Academy Award for such a great film as West Side Story, the top of your creativity, but you've also achieved a creative success in another world, and that is with the George Chakiris Collections. Tell us about that.
Well, you know, in working in theater and all that kind of stuff, I've done a lot of traveling, and I've done a lot of work in different parts of the world. And usually when you're doing, I have an engagement like that, it's 7, 8, 9 months. And at that time, I had a little Italian greyhound, a little beautiful little, amazing little dog. His name was Sammy. And when I came back from I was doing a play in London, and this is about 10 years ago. And I came back and I looked at Sammy, my incredible little guy, And I thought, you know, 7, 8, 9 months is a long time out of his life. And I decided I was going to stay home, not go anywhere, just, you know, take a break. And then just by accident, I started taking jewelry, silversmithing lessons, classes in the evening. And little by little, it just took over. I loved doing it so much. And without trying to create a collection, that never occurred to me at the time. I was just doing it because I wanted to stay home with my great little dog. The creative thing of doing this was, it just took over. It absolutely took over. And a few years had went by, and without realizing it, I had kind of like the beginning of a collection. And I worked with a manufacturer downtown Los Angeles. They helped me with some things, and they introduced me to a Japanese distributor who liked my stuff. And anyway, he's now my distributor in Japan. I mean, to flash forward to now, and I'm selling in Japan. All the department stores in Japan are just so amazing. We don't know. Our department stores are good, but they're not quite as extravagant as the Japanese department stores. But it's an incredible store called Mitsukoshi. So I've been selling there for a couple of years, and all of this happened. You know, I didn't plan it; it just happened. And now I have the website, and I'm in the process of trying to introduce my jewelry here if I can. I won't hold my breath, but that's kind of how it transpired, really, in hopefully kind of a nutshell. But I just loved doing it a lot. I mean, I took either a right or a wrong turn. I don't know, but it just took over, and the process of doing it was so gratifying that I didn't miss show business. I just didn't miss it at all. So I'm not retired from show business because my mind is always open to it, but I'm just so involved in the jewelry thing that it's kind of enough, you know, for me right now. It really is.
Well, we've got just about a minute, so I want to mention that people can check out the collection at georgechakiris.com. As I said in the opening, it's 50 years since the movie came out, West Side Story, and I understand you'll be placing your hands in cement along with Rita Moreno and Russ Tamblyn on the 15th of November.
Yeah, on the 15th of November. It's just incredible how things happen. It's to me, it's kind of like a full circle kind of thing. We're doing our handprints at Grauman's Chinese Theater on 11 o'clock in the morning. And just very quickly, if you don't have time, tell me and I'll stop. But to me, the one of the things that is kind of awesome about that, doing that, is the very first thing I studied was dance, and literally a block at 7021 from Grauman's Chinese Theater, and I rented a room a couple of blocks on the other side. I worked during the day, took class at night. 10 years later, West Side Story premieres at Grauman's Chinese Theater, and then a year later, Rita and I, you know, got the Academy Award thing, and then 50 years later, at Grauman's again, it's just, I don't know, it's a fantastic kind of circle, you know?
It's the circle of entertainment life.
Right.
George, congratulations on all you do, and I thank you so much for taking the time to talk with us.
Thank you. I appreciate your time very much. Thank you so much.
Academy Award winner George Chakiris. You can check out his website at georgechakiris.com, and you can go to my website at thestufffile.com. Go to the What's On page for this show, which is show number 0116, and you'll find links to George's website.
You're listening to The Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder. Drop Peter a line. He'd love to hear from you. You can email him at peter@thestufffile.com or catch up with him on Twitter or Facebook. There's more Stuff File coming your way in just a few moments.
Kelly Alexander's show is your place to be for everything to do with health, lifestyle, and entertainment. Join us as we chat with celebrities like Emmy winner Mia Michaels from So You Think You Can Dance, best-selling recording artist Taylor Dane, and world-renowned astronaut Julie Payette. We also cover important topics like breast cancer awareness and how to help your child through bullying. All this and more, please join us, www.kellyalexandershow.com.
It's the Kelly Alexander Show.
Capture your need for sound.
Peter Anthony Holder here. Have you ever noticed on some of those public broadcasting pledge drives, they tend to sound like ransom demands in a kidnapping?
Hey, your kids like this, Mr. Rogers. It would be most unfortune if, for some unforeseen reason, you weren't in the neighborhood no more.
Well, I'm here to ask for your support in a non-threatening, non-obligatory kind of way. Part of the success of the Stuff File depends on the generosity of its listeners worldwide. So if you can, and if you want, please feel free to make a small one-time donation. Just go to the website at thestufffile.com and click on the PayPal donation button. You can donate $10, $5, or even $1, whatever you'd like.
You know that big bird? That would be one huge drumstick, if you know what I mean.
If you have a PayPal account, it's an easy transfer. And if you don't, all major credit cards are accepted. Your generosity would be much appreciated in keeping this show running.
About that antique roadshow, they might be seeing a little more concrete than they originally anticipated.
No strong-arm tactics, no ransom demands. Just a simple please and thank you. To donate, visit thestufffile.com.
You're listening to the Stuff File program. It's the choice of 4 out of 5 dentists. The 5th dentist also listens, but that's just because he follows the crowd. Here's Peter Anthony Holder.
And still to come in the program, we'll meet world champion figure skater Lucinda Rue to talk about her new autobiography, Frozen Teardrop, and also the supervising editor of the 5th edition of the American Heritage Dictionary of the English Language. Find out some of the new words that are in there for this year. But right now, more Stuff File news for your listening pleasure. In England, 20-year-old Emma French really wanted her driver's license. Now, while in the middle of her driving test, she went into labor, had 4 contractions, but kept on going with the test. She passed and then drove herself to St. John's Hospital in Livingston, where she became a new mom for the first time. She woke up at 4 a.m. on the morning of her driving test to find out that her water had broken, but she decided to go through with the test, which she had booked at 8:40 a.m. French said, "Everyone was telling me to go to the hospital, but I had waited so long for my driving test that I was determined to do it. I didn't dare tell the examiner I was in labor in case he made me cancel the test." Now, once she got to the hospital, she went through another 6 hours of labor until her daughter, Ava McFarlane, was born at 7:30 p.m. She added, "The nurses in the hospital were very confused because I was getting congratulations cards for both my baby and my driving test. Absolutely crazy, and yet awesome," she said. You know, she's going to lose points on her new license if she doesn't have a baby car seat to ride home with. Just bringing that point up, that's all. Now, okay, this sounds like a storyline that is right out of a cheesy horror flick. But environmentalists in Argentina are not laughing. Fishermen in Cordoba, Argentina, caught a wolffish with 3 eyes in a reservoir right near a local nuclear power plant. The 3rd eye is right in the middle of the fish's head. Reportedly, the lake where the 3-eyed fish was caught is in the reservoir where hot water from the nuclear facility is pumped. Never has such a fish been seen there before. Residents who live near the reactor are worried the 3rd eye is a mutation caused by exposure to water from the nuclear plant. The fish will now be undergoing extensive testing. Wow. A fish with such good vision potential. What I want to know is, how did it get caught? Anyway, in Centerville, Utah, 53-year-old Michael Selenite has been arrested for allegedly shooting his neighbor, 41-year-old Tony Pierce, who is now battling for his life. The bullet that entered Pierce's back hit several vital organs, including the sac around his heart. Selenite has been charged with felony counts of attempted murder and unlawful weapon possession. The attempted murder charge carries the possibility of up to life in prison. But here's the worst part. Selenite told detectives he shot Pierce in self-defense with the intent to kill him because he said Pierce had telepathically raped his wife. He also claims Pierce has also been telepathically threatening to kill him and his wife. According to police reports, Selenite had been making such accusations for years, but nobody thought he was a real threat. Guess they were wrong. Time now for a major checkup from the neck up. And finally, in this section of Stuff File News, before we get to our next guest with me, Peter Anthony Holder. In Des Moines, Iowa, police have arrested 30-year-old Jennifer Christine Harris and charged her with first-degree arson. Investigators believe that Harris intentionally set fire to the home of Jim and Nikki Rasmussen, a fire that caused extensive damage and could have killed the family. The family was sleeping at the time the fire was set, but a large boom awoke them, and they managed to escape even as the siding on their house began to melt from the heat of the fire. So what was the alleged motivation? Because Mrs. Rasmussen defriended Harris on Facebook after the two got into a dispute. So when the house went up in flames, Harris became the first name that occurred to the victims, and police say an investigation supports that suspicion. Wow, seriously, can we just put the social back in social networking, please? Anyway, let's get to our next guest here on the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder. Many people know Lucinda Rue as the Queen of Spin. She was twice named one of the 25 most influential names in the world of figure skating. She also is still in the World Guinness Record Book as the holder of the longest spinner on ice. But her life wasn't always as smooth as ice, and she's written about it in her book, Frozen Teardrop, The Tragedy and Triumph of Figure Skating's Queen of Spin. She joins us on the line right now. Hi, Lucinda.
Hi, so nice to be here. Thank you so very much.
Nice to have you on the show. In going through your bio and going through the information from the book, it's somewhat amazing, considering all the things you've accomplished, what you had to go through along that route. Is part of it the fact that you're just simply a very driven person?
Well, you know what? I think I'm driven, but I think I learned that more than it was naturally innate to me. I think as a young child, I was extremely happy just, you know, playing with the birds and looking at the butterflies. But I think the skating, I mean, the sport of it, made me incredibly competitive. Also, I think always having to live in a different country, being always in a different atmosphere, always being the only odd one out, I think that made me incredibly tough and understanding of, you know, the beautiful but also extremely harsh experiences that I needed to go through. And I think that, you know, gave me an outer tough skin that, you know, I had to live with. So, but I think I'm a little bit more gentle inside than the incredibly competitiveness that I had to attain as a figure skater.
You know, you come across people who succeed artistically or athletically in a certain venue in the world, and you hear stories about what their life might be like off of what they're known for. And you sometimes wonder, is it the life that you lead off the front pages, out of the realm of the public, that leads you to become who you are, or vice versa?
Yeah, I think you're quite right. I think, you know, the life you lead off whatever you're achieving or whatever you're known for is really kind of what leads you to be so great in whatever you do. Like, for instance, with me for the skating, I mean, all the hardship, you know, like I said before, always being in a foreign country, that was incredibly hard for me. And I think my escape, my pure joy was the spinning. That was something that I enjoyed so thoroughly, and I felt like that was my home. You know, I never felt like I was quite at home, no matter where I was. And I felt the spinning brought that to me. And so it was like, I want to spin longer. I want to spin faster, you know. And I think that's what made my spin so incredible. And I also think I always was more of an artist than an athlete. I consider myself a painter on the ice. I wanted to paint a picture. I was very expressive as a young child already. And I think that translated onto the ice. And, you know, I think, like an actress, I was kind of telling my story on the ice, you know, trying to, I didn't want to say it with words. I was saying it with my movements and with my body, and I was kind of laying my whole life onto the ice, and that's what it felt like to me.
To go from someone who is a world-class skater and to be someone who ends up, well, basically bedridden,
yes,
agoraphobic,
yes,
starving,
yes,
it's a complete 180, actually, to use a spinning term. It's a complete 180 from what you have to do to be a world-class athlete. What's the mindset that goes on, and how do you pull yourself out from something like that, knowing the background you have as someone who has to take care of themselves and has to train to be the kind of skater you are?
Well, I think, you know, also the type of skater I was incredibly not balanced, because I wasn't, you know, just doing a little bit jumps, a little bit spins, and it wasn't like I wanted to be an Olympic champion. I wanted to be the best at something and do something that nobody else in the world had ever done. And to be that extreme in just one certain area, I mean, maybe, you know, you must be a little nuts somewhere to be able, you know, to really have that focus and want to be the only person in the world to do that. So I think, yeah, it's amazing. You know, I had so much balance on the ice, and off the ice I was completely imbalanced. But I think I just had to be so extreme. And on the ice I could focus all of that into the spins. Off the ice it was just a little bit more of a mess. But on the ice I was able to achieve it. So.
You say there was a lack of balance in your life. Looking back at it, you know, hindsight is always 20/20.
Yeah.
Could you have had more balance and been as successful as you were on the ice? You think that's possible?
I don't think so. I mean, I really don't think so. I think there's, you know, a sacrifice for everything that you do in life, and I don't regret it, and I actually wouldn't want it any other way. I'm so in love with the life that I've had, even with the harsh experiences that I've lived through. I'm incredibly in love with it, and I don't regret anything. The only thing I do regret is actually that I wish I could have enjoyed my spins as much as maybe my fans had, or as much as my family has had. I think I was struggling so much inside of me that I wasn't able to enjoy it as much. But, you know, I really don't think without the extreme mindset of what I wanted to achieve, I don't think it would have been possible.
So,
in terms, I kind of damaged myself while achieving a different dream.
So having said that you really wouldn't change anything, what do you want to say to others out there, particularly young girls who think, oh gosh, I want to be just like Lucinda Roux on ice? Does it kind of scare them off to what you went through off ice to want to succeed as you did?
Well, you know, I mean, a lot of the things that I went through off ice wasn't really my doing or my choice or even my parents' choice. It was kind of the circumstances that I was in. Unfortunately, we were living, it was in foreign countries. You know, those things. But, of course, physically what happened to me because of the spins, you know, I was suffering from incredible brain concussions, ongoing brain concussions as I was spinning. And that was causing a lot of the problems physically for me off the ice. So, you know, I don't want it to scare away young, you know, girls that are like, oh, my gosh, I want to spin like her. But I do want to show kind of like the warning signs a little bit. And I want to be able to explain to them that, you know, for me, to become a champion in life is always the most important thing. And I think champion in life means to be achieving your dream, but by achieving your dream, never losing yourself, your self-worth, or your self-respect. Because in the end, if you won, you have achieved your dream, but you don't have yourself, then who did you win for? And that, I think, was where I lost it. And I wish someone could have guided me a little bit better in that way. But, you know, it was my life, and I love being the best spinner in the world, and I just have to live with the consequences. But I wish for others to be able to see those warning signs and maybe tone it down just a little bit. They don't have to be that extreme like I was.
What are the consequences you're living with today?
Well, definitely the ongoing brain concussions were extremely debilitating for me. I still suffer from loss of balance. I have back fractures. That was from the spins. I injured my body quite a different couple places, so I'm still living with that. And I think the brain concussions, they have long-term effects that need quite a lot of time to be healed from. So I'm still living with those, you know. It's for instance, I cannot drive a car because I get dizzy very quickly and I will faint. And so if I look very long at a certain place, you know, when you're driving, then I'll lose my sense of balance. So those are the things, but it's not, for me, I don't know, I still love my life. I couldn't replace it for anything, so.
In this day and age, in professional sports, we're hearing more and more about concussions, and a lot of professional sports, like football, like hockey, are changing the way they do things to deal with brain injuries, to deal with concussions. Do you think figure skating will change so that people can't do what you did in your career?
Yeah, I mean, I wish, you know, they could come to some certain point, but skating is going to be a lot harder to prove the brain concussions, because, you know, if it's football, it's like a blow to the head or two heads, you know, crashing together, or you fall on your head. So skating, spinning, it's a little bit harder to prove, but I wish, they would study that a little bit more and definitely put a little bit of a stop to it. I mean, even now when I go to the ice, I have some young prodigies coming up and I work with them every day, and I make sure that they just spin, you know, just enough but not too much to really cause any damage to them. And I think it needs to be, yeah, people need to be much more aware of this in the skating world as well.
And how do you know when it's not too much? I mean, when you look at the analogy, you think about it, when you're spinning, it's almost like shaken baby syndrome.
I mean, definitely. I mean, if you think about it, I mean, I'm not in the Guinness Book for the fastest, but I am known to be also the fastest. I was clocked at 6 rotations a second. So you can imagine the force. You know, they were saying, the doctors were saying I had almost the same force as like an airline pilot, like a fighter jet pilot. The force to the brain is enormous. And I remember spinning. I used to like hear my brain crack. There were some positions where I would just faint right out of the spin. So I think because I've experienced that, I can also tell. I mean, I'm not a doctor, but I can tell a little bit when I have my skaters. I can start to tell when they're starting to lose a little bit of that balance, or their eyes, you know, are a little bit cloudy and turn a little bit funny, and I stop with them, you know. So, but spinning is, you know, everyone gets dizzy when they spin. Even I mean, I was incredibly dizzy when I was spinning, so... Yes, your body does adjust to it and get a little bit used to it, but it still affects your body. And, you know, when you do have concussions, it also damages the pituitary gland. And so there are a lot of things that, you know, can affect the body that are still maybe not researched to the fullest degree.
It's a fascinating topic and a fascinating story from a fascinating career. The book is called Frozen Teardrop, The Tragedy and Triumph of Figure Skating's Queen of Spin, written by Lucinda Roux. And Lucinda, I thank you very, very much for taking the time to be on the program with us.
No, thank you again. It was a pleasure.
Lucinda Roux, author of Frozen Teardrop, The Tragedy and Triumph of Figure Skating's Queen of Spin. You can go to my website at thestufffile.com, go to the What's On page for this show, which is show number 0116, and you'll find links to Lucinda's website and also links to either Amazon.com or Amazon.ca, where you can order her book directly. You're listening to The Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder.
I'm Bob DiRico-Jones, and this is Let's Be Fair. As a consumer watchdog, I keep an eye out for abusive lawsuits that can rob Americans of the choices we have for medical treatment. Our legal system allows lawyers to file unfounded lawsuits against medical providers and pharmaceutical companies, even when there's no scientific evidence to support them. Here's an example. One of the options that smokers now have when they want to kick the habit is a prescription called Chantix. Like many new drugs, Chantix quickly became the target of personal injury lawyers, and if you Google the words Chantix lawsuits, you'll find 500,000 results. Now, very few things are more important than the safety of our medicine. But the FDA just released two studies that strongly suggest this drug is no more likely to cause harmful side effects than other accepted nicotine replacement therapies. Let's be fair, lawsuits with no scientific basis might enrich some lawyers, but they can rob the rest of us of safe and effective medical treatment. Find out how we're all affected. Go to our website at centerforamerica.org.
Informed or entertained? Hey, you're doing both. This is The Stuff File with Peter Anthony Holder.
And still to come on the program, we'll talk to the supervising editor of the American Heritage Dictionaries. And, of course, we do have an idiot of the day. But right now, a couple more Stuff File stories before we get to our last guest. A house in Euclid, Ohio, is arousing interest from ghost researchers because the owner claims that she has seen two ghosts having sex with each other. Diane Carlisle claims that she has seen hot afterlife action going on in her living room and even captured it on camera. Diane says it looks like two ghosts having sex. Ohio-based investigator David Jones says if it's true, it represents an extraordinary development in paranormal research. Jones says ghosts are examples of residual energy that get imprinted on a certain location and aren't always from dead people. It's possible that the ghost could be Carlisle from an earlier age, he said. But paranormal researcher Alexandra Holzer, whose dad, Heinz Holzer, was a pioneer in the field, says the case, while unusual, is not uncommon, explaining, "These could be two spirits who knew each other in life and have a connection to the house." Holzer recommends more research be done on the house and says that might require researchers as well as psychics who can communicate with any of the spirits who may be lurking. You know, I've read the story, but all the way through, the only thing I could register in my mind was, hot diggity, there is a chance for a little horizontal mambo after death. Apparently it's not just for terrorists only. Anyway, a department store loss prevention officer in Port St. Lucie, Florida, spotted Joseph Wilson, age 50, allegedly hiding $174 in men's socks and underwear under his clothing. The officer then followed Wilson out of the store and confronted him next to a van in the parking lot. Wilson jumped into the van and told the driver to take off. The driver refused, so Wilson ran. He was eventually caught hiding behind a trash bin and arrested for theft. Now, it's a milestone for Wilson. He has 37 prior felony arrests, 47 misdemeanor arrests, and 15 unknown arrests prior to the shoplifting incident, which makes this arrest his 100th. Yes, let's all celebrate the centennial, shall we? And maybe to celebrate, how about life in prison as a habitual offender? I'm just saying, it might be a good idea. Anyway, let's get to our last guest here on the program, shall we? A little over a year ago, we talked to Stephen Kleinedler, who is the supervising editor of the American Heritage Dictionaries. Now, back then, we talked to him about the book 100 Words Almost Everyone Mixes Up or Mangles. Now, this time around, we're talking about the latest edition of their dictionary. It's the fifth edition of the American Heritage Dictionary of the English Language. Stephen is on the line with us right now. Hi, Stephen.
Hello. Thank you so much for having me back on the air. It's always a pleasure to speak to you, Peter.
Thanks for being on with us. Each year, you guys come up and find literally new words. English, the English language is a living, breathing thing. We're never going to run out of words, are we?
That is correct. It's definitely, one can view it as almost like a living, breathing organism. And it's worth pointing out that this edition is the first new one in 11 years, so it's all of the words that we have been adding over the past decade in one large edition.
Now, with words being added to the language all the time, there are, at the other end of the spectrum, there are ones that fall out of use, correct?
That is correct, although they are not as frequent as you'd imagine for a couple of reasons. One, we try not to put words into the dictionary unless we think they're going to stay there, that they have staying power. We're rather reluctant to add flash-in-the-pan words that we don't think are going to have much staying power. And also, in this production of the new edition, through space-saving features, we were able to put in much more than we took out.
So how do you determine whether a word is or will have staying power?
I've been in the business for over 20 years. You sort of, it's part intuition, part, determining whether or not a word has reached a tipping point, if you will. You want to be cautious of entering something too soon, which is why many of the words that we have in there as new have actually been around for quite a while. There aren't very many completely brand new words that would go in right away, exceptions being, for example, when they name new elements. Once the body that makes this decision makes their decision, boom, that's it. You've got copernicium or rhenium or darmstadtium or what have you.
Okay, so give us an example of something, in your estimation, that doesn't make the cut, a word that is, as you would say, a flash in the pan.
Well, we looked at a few items that, here's a good example. We considered adding the word cyber citizen, but ultimately did not for a couple of reasons. One, cyber is a productive prefix. You can attach it in front of just about any word. You can have easily a dictionary of words that begin with the word cyber. But more importantly, it was supplanted by a different word that is used for that, and that is netizen. For that reason, we thought, well, cyber citizen doesn't need to go in. Sometimes they're a little too slangy, like the term annoyicon for those little graphics you see on the corners of cable stations and televisions, you know, that identify the what station or network it's affiliated with. You know, it's a cute word, but we thought it was a little too cutesy and more slangy and didn't know if it was going to have the staying power, so we didn't add it.
Well, I work in television, and we just call them bugs.
Bugs, yes. Bugs is a less slangy term for that.
Now, it's interesting. You mentioned the word cyber citizen. So are you saying that no term with the word cyber could be in the dictionary, or just
one? We have there are probably close to two dozen terms, definitely over a dozen. I'm looking there now.
Well,
with terms beginning with cyber, it's just that you could theoretically have pages and pages because cyber is a productive prefix that can be thrown in front of just about any word.
Let me ask you, would the term cyber stalker make it? Because that to me is something that I sadly would be here to stay.
It's something we would consider, but again, it's pretty transparent if you know what the meaning of the prefix cyber is. A cyber stalker would be a stalker who operates over an electronic medium. Cyberspace is a little more hard to grasp by putting the two together, or a cybrarian, a cybernetic librarian, or someone who specializes in finding information in the internet. There you don't have the actual cyber prefix, so that's the type of thing we would add. But yes, you're right, cyber stalker is a valid word, just as are dozens of other words beginning with the word cyber, but for space limitations, we don't list them all, much in the same way that we don't list every possible word beginning with un or pre or re, because the prefix is so productive.
So let's look at some of the things that did go into the dictionary this year. I'm actually kind of surprised. I'm looking at the press release that came along with this. The vulgar slang term, and I think we can say it on the program, asshat. That's actually in the dictionary?
Yes. That's one term everyone, all the radio stations have picked up on, and everyone else has said it, so I'm assuming you probably can too. It's almost all of the terminology we put in is not slang. We're not known for being a slang dictionary, but there are a handful of slang terms that make it, just to show the vibrancy of the language. It's a word that gets wide usage in a variety of written and spoken materials, and it's kind of funny, so, you know, we have a sense of humor. We did not, however, enter ass clown.
Okay. How many of the, is there any way of telling a percentage of the words, because you alluded to it earlier, a percentage of the words that come from either medicine or science?
I can give you a rough estimate. I would be willing to say close to 40%.
And so that
another large area of work, new terminology would be foods, cuisines, as the North American palate becomes more and more global. So we have a lot of South Indian foods, a lot of Arabic foods, South American, and even newer Italian words like ciabatta for the type of loafy, crusty bread that you can now get with sandwiches, which, you know, certainly has existed in Italian for centuries and has been around for a while, but now even fast food chains talk about ciabatta bread in their advertising.
Which brings me to my next question, and that is that the English language is such a sponge of other languages. I would assume a lot of words come from other languages.
Most words, unless it is a word that is created from two English words, like flexitarian for a flexible vegetarian. Most words do come from other languages. Originally, you know, medieval French, Latin, Greek. Nowadays, you'll see a lot of words coming in from Spanish, Arabic, and especially these cultural terms that describe clothing or food from other cultures are often based on or taken from foreign languages.
One of the words I find interesting, backronym.
Backronym. You know, on this list, we have a handful of words that linguists and word lovers use to describe linguistic and other word phenomenon. A backronym is a kind of acronym. It's when you take an existing word and you make up an acronym for it. It's not how the word came to be, but it's something that people will refer to it as. And we give the example of Wiki, which is not from What I Know Is. Wiki actually comes from a either Hawaiian or a Polynesian language. So saying that Wiki is a backronym used for What I Know Is, it's kind of a whimsical way about taking a word and ascribing to it this kind of acronymic meaning, even though when it's not an actual acronym.
One of the other words I see on the list, which is one I'm saying a lot of these days of as a news anchor because it comes up a lot, and that is fracking, which deals with getting oil out of the ground in high pressure with water.
Right. Fracking is a shortened form of the phrase hydraulic fracturing, and as you mentioned, that is a process that is becoming more and more common in North America and is in some cases being theoretically linked to excess earthquakes or groundwater poisoning, which is one reason why it's been in the news so much. And here's a good example of a technique that's been around for a while, but because of its prominence in a variety of news media and outlets, it was worth entering. And then, of course, from hydraulic fracturing, the shortening fracking that is used to describe it.
And do you find sometimes that in a lot of cases, media can drive a word?
It can draw a word?
Drive a word, another propel it.
Drive a word, absolutely.
Yeah.
Yeah, there are hundreds, if not thousands or tens of thousands of chemical compounds that you would never think of adding into a regular dictionary. I mean, you could go on for days and days talking about all the chlorides and bromates and nitrates and everything. An example of something that we added due to attention given to it is bisphenol A, which is it's a compound that is used in resins and plastics, and it was a few years ago thought possibly could leach carcinogens into the liquids that it held. It was being used in, like, runner's bottles and that kinds of things, and that's definitely a term that the media brought to prominence as this chemical was being discovered, and, you know, as such, we thought it merited inclusion.
Another word that we've come across a lot in the news as well, it seems to be that this is a great book to have in newsrooms, but also in schools and just in homes everywhere. It's the fifth edition of the American Heritage Dictionary of the English Language. I thank you very much, Stephen, for being on the program with us once again.
Thank you. I'd like to remind listeners it's available in online and brick-and-mortar bookstores, and there is the definitions are available at ahdictionary.com, and there's also apps available through Apple or Android.
Stephen Kleinedler, the supervising editor of the American Heritage Dictionaries. The latest is the fifth edition of the American Heritage Dictionary of the English Language. As Stephen mentioned, you can check out their website at ahdictionary.com. You can also go to my website at thestufffile.com. Go to the What's On page for this show, which is show number 0116, and you'll find links to their website and also links to either amazon.com or amazon.ca, where you can order the book directly. You're listening to The Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder. Time now for The Idiot of the Day.
And now it's time for The Strange Things Adults Do. The Stuff File presents The Idiot of the Day.
And thanks to listener Bob Steele for getting this story to our attention. A pilfered Reuben sandwich and a stolen forklift have a Pittsburgh man in quite a pickle. Ross Township Police said 38-year-old Sean Faulkner ordered the sandwich from a bar, then ran out without paying and climbed onto a forklift for his getaway. Faulkner allegedly stole the forklift from a construction site, then drove it 2 miles to Sieb's Pub. Bartender Carrie Donatelli says Faulkner ordered the sandwich, then bolted from the door after his food arrived. Investigators say Faulkner was still in the parking lot when officers arrived. Police say he couldn't get the forklift to go into reverse. Faulkner is at the Allegheny County Jail on charges of theft and receiving stolen property. Why would someone steal a forklift when clearly they can't even drive it? And I'm not even going to bring up the whole sandwich thing. One reason and one reason only, he's an idiot!
Gee, I'm only a kid, but even I know you're an idiot.
And that's it for this edition of the Stuff File program number 0116. Hope you enjoyed it. The website is thestufffile.com. And again, stuff is spelled S-T-U-P-H. And if you go to the website, you'll find information and links on all of our guests by going to the weekly Stuff File page. Just look for the corresponding program number. And again, that's 0116. Email me at peter@thestufffile.com. And also, you can find me on Facebook and Twitter as PA Holder. And don't forget to check out the Stuff File store, where you can purchase a plethora of Stuff File merchandise, from t-shirts to mugs to tote bags to mouse pads. Hope to see you back here for our next show on the air, online, or as a download. We're coming to you from everywhere, including CyberStationUSA.com, KDXRadio.com, AirChecker, Canada's number one radio source, streaming on PCJ Media and its partner stations, aboard China Airlines, and also over the air on World FM in New Zealand, MediaCorp in Singapore, and WSTJ in St. Johnsbury, Vermont. Bye-bye.
Been listening to the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder, a presentation of Flying Fish Communications. Any rebroadcast of this copywritten program in whole or in part without the express written consent of...
Oh, God, who the hell are we kidding? Who's going to steal this show? God, who writes this stuff? Holder, what a kidder.